The Neurodivergent Woman podcast acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community.
We pay our respect to elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Hello, this is the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
Hi, I'm Monique Mitchelson and I'm a clinical psychologist.
And I'm Michelle Livock, and I'm a clinical neuropsychologist.
Michelle and I met at work and bonded over a shared love of feminism and yoga.
We both saw the need to provide a free resource to adult neurodivergent women. And so the Neurodivergent Woman podcast was born.
Michelle is neurotypical.
And Monique is neurodivergent.
And we bring our clinical expertise and lived experience to the topics we explore. This is a podcast where we center and showcase neurodivergent women from all walks of life.
Covering autism to ADHD and everything in between, we aim to educate and inspire women who think differently.
Today on the podcast, we have a guest that I'm very excited to interview. Associate Professor Josephine Barbaro is a Principal Research Fellow and Psychologist at the Olga Tennyson Autism Research Centre at La Trobe University, Melbourne. She is the Research Director of Identification and Diagnosis of Autism and the Clinical Director of the Victorian Early Assessment Clinic, providing neuroaffirming transdisciplinary assessments for neurodivergence in children under 3 years of age. Josie's research interests are in the early identification and diagnosis of autism, family health and well-being following a diagnosis, and neurodiversity affirming research and practice. She is a late identified autistic ADHDer and has a gorgeous preschooler and cat who share the same neurotype as her. Oh, I love that. So, Josie, thanks for coming on today. I'd love to start with our first question, which is, what does neurodivergence mean to you? And what is your experience of being a neurodivergent child psychologist and working in academia as a neurodivergent autism researcher?
Thanks, Monique. So I guess it's been a really long journey for me, actually. I started in the autism research space 20 years ago, and lots has changed, obviously, since then in terms of what neurodivergence is. I guess for me, it's obviously the way in which we see and perceive the world is different and unique, and that there's nothing to be ashamed about that, because there's always been such shame around difference. And I think it's quite empowering when you know your neurotype and preferences, and you realize that you've already gathered, you know, a whole group of friends and family that are very similar to you because they share the same neurotype. So for me, it's just about understanding, acceptance, and embracing, I guess, you know, our unique ways of engaging and sensing the world. In terms of being an autism researcher and neurodivergent autism researcher and clinician, like I mentioned before, it's been such a long journey. So when I first started in this field, you know, I was 19 years of age. You know, I did my honours thesis on, back then, it was called Autism and Asperger's. And I was really fascinated with child development. And so autism was one of the topics that sort of came up. And, you know, I went into that space unaware, obviously, that I'm autistic and ADHD myself, and went through 18 years, really, of seeing autism as something that was, that other people, you know, other people were autistic and I was not. I was neurodivergent. I knew I was neurodivergent for, you know, quite a while, since I was in my late teens, but not autistic. And so I guess it's helped me to understand how and why things are different for me. So I noticed that things that came easy to others were quite difficult for me, because I would then have to put in 10 times the amount of work to get there. The way in which we engage in the workplace, you know, I always wondered why, I guess, I felt different in the workplace and never really felt like I fit in. And so I guess having this newfound understanding has helped me, I guess, to be kinder to myself, understand that, you know, it's about being different and not less. And it's also given me the ability to engage with children, autistic children, in a way that I think not many people are able to, because of, I guess, this shared, you know, neurotype. You know, these young babies that would come through the clinic, you know, 12, 18, 24 months of age, I'd be able to just get an instant connection with these kids. And parents were quite surprised at how quickly I'd be able to do that. You know, they would say, oh, it's going to be a long time. I'm not sure if he's going to last the whole session. We end up having a great time. Also, the way in which I guess, converse with parents who are often neurodivergent themselves has been really fantastic to get to know, I guess, the insights of other neurodivergent parents, but has also given me the ability to engage with them in ways in which they really understand, because, you know, obviously many parents are neurodivergent themselves. So for me, it's about being, you know, finding my way as being an autism researcher for such a long time, but not working in the adult space. And then I guess later in life, understanding that I myself am neurodivergent, and it's given me a space to be able to understand autism much better through a research lens, a lived experience lens, and a clinical lens, and as a parent as well of an autistic kid. So, yeah, I have a lot of different lenses in which I can, draw from, and it makes the research better, it makes the clinical work better, and it helps me to understand my life better as well.
Yeah, amazing to see your journey of your own self-discovery alongside your clinical work and, you know, the advances that we've had, particularly in the past, you know, 10 years or so around autism in particular in research. So I love just to see that journey of growth side by side, both professionally and personally. And, you know, I love the point that you made about when we are working with neurodivergent children, you know, both autism and ADHD, I believe the research says that autism is around 90% heritable. So that often means that if you have an autistic child presenting for assessment or therapy or with early signs that they have an autistic neurotype, it often means that at least one of the parents, and sometimes both, and extended family members are also autistic. And similarly with ADHD, I believe it's around a 70% heritability, you know, with various studies quoting different statistics. But the likelihood of being ADHD, when you have an ADHD family member, in particular a sibling or, you know, your child is ADHD, yeah, that increases the likelihood of other family members being ADHD as well. And I really think, you know, part of our responsibility as clinicians and researchers working in this space is to be aware of this perspective and what the research has showed around this heritability, that it is mainly genetic, and really think about what that means for working with families holistically and as a whole unit. And so I love that you really work with the child, but then also the parents. And we should be screening parents and extended family members for autism and ADHD when we are working with an autistic and or ADHD child.
Yeah, absolutely. We've always known, obviously, about the heritability of autism and how strongly linked it is to genetics. And a good example of that is when you have an autistic child, the likelihood that your next child is autistic was quoted as 20%. I think that's higher now. But let's just say it's 20%. Then if you have another child, your second child, the likelihood that they are autistic doubles to 40%. And then if you have a third child, that doubles to 80%. So I guess some people were thinking about that in terms of, oh, well, there's something to do with the mother and their body and this and that. But actually what it's showing is that in that family, autism is so heritable that the likelihood that your whole family is autistic is really, really high. And I think we need to flip the narrative. It's not about how likely you are to be autistic or ADHD. It's how likely are you not to be autistic or ADHD, because that's the lower figure. So really, I could sort of come from the assumption that if you have an autistic child or, you know, family members, that there's a likelihood. I'm not going to assume that's the case. But the way in which you engage with that family in a neurodiversity-affirming way is going to be beneficial for all people, because neurodiversity-affirming practice benefits all. So absolutely, we need to, I guess, make parents aware of the heritability of autism in families, so that they perhaps, you know, use the skills that they're engaging with their autistic child with all the kids in you know, their family. And also, I think we've come a long way in, I guess, destigmatizing neurodivergence in women, because again, back in the day, and I say back in the day, like I'm, you know, was born in the 1930s, but, 20 years ago or so, we'd often have a kid that would come in, you know, they'd receive a diagnosis, and we would notice, oh, okay, Aspie dad, you know, a father with Asperger's, and anxious mother. It was not that at all. It was that they were both autistic, and the woman was just assumed to be anxious and not autistic. And so we've come such a long way now, and really are identifying that obviously, you know, mothers and women are, you know, just as likely to be autistic as well. So I couldn't agree more in terms of, you know, screening and also discussing about heritability in families.
So chatting about, you know, working with young children, tell us about your work on the early identification of autism.
So I started my PhD back in 2005. And, you know, I've always wanted to be a clinician. So I did my undergrad in behavioral science, wanting to be a psychologist. But I was drawn to the research world as well. But we couldn't do the combined clinical and PhD training at the time, unfortunately. So I had to choose one. So I chose PhD, but with, you know, the strict proviso that it was a very applied project, because for me, anything that I do in research must have a direct impact, positive impact on the community in which, you know, we're researching. And one of the topics was screening for autism in our maternal and child health system in Victoria. And so, you know, I went about a really thorough review of the literature and looked at all the screening tools available, all of the early signs of autism available. And this is back in the day before we had, I guess, the technology where you could sort things via computer packages. And so I literally would print out all of the papers in piles and then sticky label them with, you know, each of the themes. I mean, honestly, how did I not know back then, really? So I was just systematizing the lit review without, you know, all of the fancy stuff we have today to be able to do it. And so I spent a year doing this, and I found the signs of autism that were the most predictive of a diagnosis. So this is right across the spectrum. So not just children with low or high support needs, so right across. And so I developed this methodology called social attention and communication surveillance, or SACS. And what it was checklists at 12 months, 18 months and 24 months of age of social and communication behaviours. So things such as responding to name, or smiling when someone smiles at you, so a reciprocal smile, or, you know, use of eye contact, or engaging in pretend play. And so they were at each of the ages between one and two, and I trained maternal child health nurses, over 240 of them in Victoria, on what autistic development looks like in young children, what non-autistic development looks like, how to use the checklists, and how to talk to families. So we engaged in this really large screening study. We screened over 22,000 children. It was a really big project. I was often told that this is too much, you shouldn't do it. And I said, I know it's too much and I want to do it, so I will. and so, you know, the children were screened in the maternal child health centres. If they're identified at a high likelihood of being autistic based on the methodology that I developed, so it's only five behaviours at each age, that was sent to us at or referred to us at La Trobe. I undertook an assessment of these children. I followed them up every 6 months until they were two. And, you know, I gave a diagnosis if it was required for that child of autism or developmental delay or whatnot. And so through that process, we found that 81% of all kids that were identified at a higher likelihood of being autistic were autistic. So it was the most accurate tool in the world, and it still is in terms of, you know, identifying kids early. And so that for me really just sort of set, you know, my career off on this trajectory. And I did a follow-up study where, you know, I worked with a student to develop a preschool checklist. So now it goes up to 5 years of age. And then in 2018, the Victorian government, we were successful in getting a grant from the Victorian government to train every single maternal and child health nurse in Victoria on the SACS. So every child under five is screened for the autistic neurotype via SACS. And for me, that was such a wonderful achievement, but also a wonderful outcome, because whenever I'm out in the streets and I see little ones, I'm like, oh, they would have, you know, been screened with my tool, and hopefully they're on the right path if they need the extra support. So the last big study that we did on SACS, which included the SACS preschool check, we screened over 13,500 children, again, in the maternal child health system. And that was so that we could replicate the results and see if we could improve as well. And so we found that, again, accuracy was really high. 83% of all children who were identified at high likelihood on SACS were autistic, and 96% of all autistic kids were identified by the preschool age. So it's not only accurate, but it's identifying the majority of these children. So that was, yeah, quite a long journey. That took about 15 years all up to do those. And so, yeah, it's been a really long journey, and it's led to also development of technologies as well for early identification.
Josie, that is incredible. I think that's a lot of work, and B, incredibly useful, not just for the autistic community, but I think for society in general. And I would love to see this early identification screening rolled out amongst all child health nurses in Australia, because, you know, we're going to get into this in our next question a little bit, but I do think there are a lot of positives that can come with early identification. So I think the fact that we have a tool that was produced in Australia that is the most accurate in the world is incredible.
Yeah, and, you know, it's something that is easily adaptable, you know, culturally adaptable, and implemented in various settings, because, you know, since that first study, and then I did that second study with over 13,000 kids, we have translated and implemented this across 17 countries, including really low-resourced settings like Nepal, Bangladesh. So we've worked really closely with local community to be able to adapt this program with lived experience of people of that particular culture or background, rather than just translating the language. You can't do that. You have to culturally adapt it. So that's one of the best things in terms of this tool, is being able to work with local community. And just recently, I've been training five master trainers, they're called. So I train people on how to train on SACS in Sri Lanka, India, and Nepal across five languages. And, you know, they film themselves with the babies, engaging with them, and they're just so warm and nurturing and just wonderful to see, you know, in these vastly different cultures, that something that we've developed here in Australia can be used there and used in an affirming way as well. And so I think that it's really important that something can be culturally adapted with lived experience, not just of neurodivergence, but of that culture. And we've done the same with the app that we've developed out of this research. So this app we've developed is called AS Detect. It's free. It's on Google and Apple stores, and it has the SACS questions in there with videos, short videos that parents can use. They look at the videos, they answer a question, and then they get a result as to the likelihood that their child might be autistic or not. And then they can send that off to their doctor.
So, Josie, wow. Like, I'm kind of speechless, to be honest. This is just ticking a lot of boxes for me as a clinician. I have no research experience, but, you know, even just the stuff that I was taught as a psychologist at university on research methodology and things like that, and what I've learned working within the autistic community, it sounds to me like you really have put the effort into true co-production. And I think as well, whenever we're looking at working with any minority population, it's really helpful to involve a researcher that has lived experience of that minority population in the creation of the study and the tools and the evaluation process. Because what I often see is that if you don't involve on a research level, let alone co-production with the community that that research is going to affect, often the right questions aren't asked in how the research study is designed and what it's covering. And what can sometimes happen is the implicit biases that we all hold. You know, every person on this earth holds implicit bias. When research is undertaken by people who form that majority in the population, they will often miss things. And then we end up seeing bias unknowingly perpetuated in research, which then gets perpetuated in, you know, our institutions and training of clinicians. And what I really see, you know, in great examples like yourself is trying to break down this bias. And this is why I think it is really important for there to be autistic researchers involved in research on autism. And I love that you have then involved people in the communities that your research is rolled out in terms of adaptation and cultural adaptations as well, because that is incredibly important. Otherwise, the research does not get translated correctly. And again, there are all sorts of biases that can occur. So this is just music to my ears.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's across everything that we engage with in the world. And there are really great examples of this outside of neurodivergence in terms of the way in which our world is built. So, you know, in that book, In Invisible Woman, one of the examples that was given was how seatbelts are designed for the male body and not for bodies that have breasts, for example. And so it can cause, they can cause harm, you know, to the female body, or to bodies that have breasts. And that is because, I guess, men just didn't think about it, right, when they were developing seatbelts. And even something as simple as soap dispensers, and this might seem really random, but it sticks in my mind. The soap dispensers that have, you know, the infrared sort of lights that can determine that a hand is there to the soap to be dispensed, it literally wasn't working for people with darker skin, because they were tested on people with just white skin. And so then there was, you know, these viral posts saying that soap dispensers are racist, which essentially, yes, that's how it came to be. So we absolutely need lived experience from design of the research question, in developing the research protocol, in interpreting the results, and then in implementation. So if it doesn't start all the way back from even the conception of the question, do we want this? Does the autistic community want this, or neurodivergent community want this or not? And often what we hear is that we parents with young kids, they want help with sleep, feeding, you know, toileting, everyday things. But then others can get so, I guess, focused on, you know, looking at developmental outcomes, which is still important, of course, but things that impact us as parents are those everyday skills. So ask autistic people and parents, what do they want? What will make their life better?
Yeah, I 100% agree. You know, to me, when you're working with a minority population, you should probably do like a scoping study, which actually canvasses that community for what are the issues that the people within that community think are important and should be addressed, and what are the solutions that they would like as well to ensure the usefulness and utility of what you're actually doing. And I think as well, you know, when you are a researcher, when you are a registered health and mental health professional, and particularly, you know, if you're registered, for example, with a regulatory body, like in Australia, it would be APRA. And then researchers have their own ethical, you know, regulatory boards and bodies and all of that. The burden of prevention of any harm, including inadvertent harm, the burden of that responsibility really lies on the clinicians and the researchers, and it really needs to be considered carefully and the ethics of everything really thought out in terms of the pros and cons for the communities that your research is about.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for any of our listeners who are interested, we will be linking the SACS training for the tool and the AS Detect app on the show notes of this episode. Hi, it's Monique here. I have some exciting news. I teamed up with a fellow neurodivergent clinical psychologist called Jennifer Kemp to write a book. It's called The Neurodivergent Skills Workbook for Autism and ADHD. Cultivate Self-Compassion, Live Authentically, and Be Your Own Advocate by New Harbinger Publishers. It's out on the 1st of July this year, so spread the word. So how are you trying to close the gap in the diagnostic age for autistic girls and assigned female at birth children?
When I started, you know, in the field, the average, I guess, ratio of females to males diagnosed was 4 males to every 1 female. And we know that that gap is much smaller. And, you know, I'm thinking that it's more like 1 to 2 or even less. And so after I did my PhD, I went back and then did my training in educational and developmental psychology, and I had to do another thesis, even though I had done a PhD thesis, but I did another one. And I'm like, okay, if I'm going to do one, I want to do it in something that I'm passionate about. And that was in seeing if we can identify more autistic girls, women, gender diverse kids, you know, early in life. So I compared the females and the males in our study in terms of their social communication behaviours, and I actually didn't find any differences in the way that children presented in these earlier ages, likely because you are your authentic self, you know, when you're really young. They haven't yet gotten to that point where they're starting to engage in masking, which is obviously very harmful. So I didn't see any differences in terms of the way that the social communication differences presented. But what I did find is that fewer females were referred at 12 months of age. So for every girl referred, 12 boys were referred. But then when we got to 18 months of age, for every girl referred, 3 boys were referred. So it really declined because I guess people were either more confident in referring young girls or the signs were becoming clearer. So we're not sure about that. But what I do in my training now is I really emphasize this discrepancy and say there aren't fewer autistic girls at 12 months. It's that they're not being referred. So let's keep a close eye on these girls that might be showing some of these signs and make sure that we continue to monitor children's development across time. You know, we shouldn't just be doing a screening at one time. And so for me, it's about monitoring, obviously, children's development across time and really educating health professionals that, you know, autism isn't just a male neurotype. It's right across, you know, the gender spectrum.
Yeah, I think, you know, there certainly is gender bias present in a lot of different layers of things in psychology around autism and tools used, but often it is the like stereotypes that the public has and also that health professionals often have around autism being mainly a male, you know, quote unquote condition. And what that means is that there may be signs that a girl or a gender diverse person is autistic, but it's not even registered because that stereotype blocks the processing of information accurately. And there has been research that has showed that health professionals actually have just as much implicit bias as the general population, even if they have, you know, years and years of training and are taught to self-reflect and do supervision. Unfortunately, you know, the training that you do doesn't protect you against these biases. And so having an education campaign that deconstructs some of these biases for the public, but also for professionals and researchers is helpful because we see this even with ADHD. So, for example, in some of the training that I do, I quote a study that was done 20 years ago and nothing has really changed for like ADHD. And basically in this study, they gave teachers vignettes of ADHD traits and they kind of changed the pronouns of the child in these vignettes. And what they found was that even though the traits in the vignette were the same, the vignettes that were given the male pronoun were referred for like assessment and support for ADHD, but the vignettes with the female name were not by the teachers. And this was also shown in like studies around parents as well, like actually underestimating ADHD traits in the female children versus the male children. So I think it's just a good demonstration of some of the issues around trying to close this gap.
Yeah, no, that's really powerful research to show, you know, those biases. And, you know, for me, I'm still continuing to do more and more research in what I call the internalized presentation. Yes, the majority of the time, internalized presentations tend to be in females or women, but obviously can present in men as well. Because what I really want to know is why is this huge, you know, lost generation essentially of autistic women? So what I'm doing is we're doing a research project with some PhD students on recruiting later diagnosed girls, women, gender diverse people. So after 8 to 10 years of age, so not identified until after that time, and then getting videotapes of these children when they were babies. And then we're going to look at these videos and compare them to the babies that we pick up when they're really young to see, are there any differences in how they present? Are there any differences between the males and the females? Because I want to see, is it that there genuinely are not differences in the way that girls and boys present who are autistic earlier on? So are there differences or there no differences? And if there are no differences, at what age are differences starting to emerge? Because we need to get so much better at identifying females and women at an earlier age because it's so important to know about your neurotype early. And so I guess I'm really excited about, you know, looking at videotapes of these later diagnosed women and girls to see, you know, why were these children missed for such a long time?
So what are the pros and cons of early identification and early diagnosis for people?
So I guess in the past, before the neurodiversity paradigm, there was such a heavy focus on shifting autistic traits, you know, in shifting developmental outcomes, in IQ and in all of these different areas. And like no focus at all in terms of understanding one's neurotype and identity. So for me, the most important thing for early identification is for parents to understand their child better, for parents to understand how to tune into their child the way which they understand, and not trying to, I guess, change that child into ways in which they think the child should be engaging or playing. So accepting that child for who they are, and then trying to understand how they communicate, how they, you know, ask for help, how they enjoy things, how they, you know, like playing, and then joining in the way that they like, and then having the opportunity to communicate to them that they are autistic, you know, at an early age. I have had so much pushback over the years about identifying and diagnosing kids early, because health professionals will say to me, oh, you don't want to label the child. You don't want to label that child for the rest of their life, and they've got this stigma. And I'm like, we as society are putting that stigma on the kids. We can change that. And those kids are going to be called, well, they're going to be labeled, but they're going to be labeled strange, weird, rather than autistic. And so when I've done focus groups with autistic people about early identification, they say, I hate the I don't want to label thing, because we still get labeled. We get labeled these horrible things instead of autistic. And I know what I would prefer.
Yeah, Josie, you know, I was lucky in that I wasn't bullied severely in primary school. It was a little bit different in high school, but I would get people in primary school calling me a freak or a geek. And at the time, I would say back to them proudly, I'm not Monique the freak or Monique the geek. I am Monique the unique.
Awesome.
Yeah. So I think, you know, a lot of parents as well can sometimes have fears about their child being treated differently if they have a label or the stigma that their child may face. But to be honest, we kind of face that anyway, with or without a label. And at least if you have an accurate explanation for what your child is experiencing as a parent, you then know what are the best strategies to support your child and really understand as well the why of your child's behaviors and experiences, rather than, I suppose, you know, sometimes we make assumptions about why children behave in certain ways or externalize their distress in certain ways. And then it also helps the child to understand and internalize that, you know, there's nothing wrong with them. They are autistic, and it's just it's a different neurotype. It's a different way of being. Certain things are harder. Yes, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge that. But it also, getting an early diagnosis really helps people not go down a negative trajectory as they get older. Because I work with adults, and mainly adult women, but also some men as well, I see the end result of that trajectory of being undiagnosed and receiving no support. And I see people, unfortunately, having gone down a trajectory of accumulating a life of trauma, addictions, difficulty with relationships, difficulty maintaining employment, developing a lot of medical conditions because of the and mental health conditions because of the intense stress that the person has trying to be neurotypical when they are actually neurodivergent and have had perhaps a hidden disability or that they never received any support for. So I would actually argue that the consequences of not getting an early diagnosis are far worse in terms of these outcomes and the quality of life than getting an early diagnosis and early identification. And a lot of the research is focused around children. And up until recently, we haven't looked at what are the actual outcomes for adults, you know, who don't get identified because they weren't picked up. And so there's no research about them, but they are populating our psychiatric hospitals. They are populating our physical and mental health services, our crisis services, our homeless services, our domestic violence services. They are populating our employment services because they are struggling. And I think it's really important to offer this perspective and acknowledge that.
Absolutely, because then the self-blame and the self-loathing of why am I different? Why can't I do it the way that everyone else can? Why do I react in this way? Why do I need this and they don't? And then internalizing that and saying, well, it just must be me. I must be inherently defective. And what an awful way to live most of your life like that, which, you know, a lot of us have. And so I think that understanding your neurotype early is so important, like you've just mentioned. And also to, I guess, avoid missing out on all the other co-occurring things, like you said, that comes along with neurodivergence, like chronic health conditions. And so there's so much diagnostic overshadowing going on as well.
So a really common question amongst parents of young autistic children is how can they best communicate this diagnosis of autism to their children? Do you have any advice on how parents can do this and how they can support their child to build a positive neurodivergent identity?
Yeah, so a colleague of mine, Marie Kamen, who I believe, you know, will be one of the guests on your show, and I, we wrote an article in The Conversation about how to, I guess, talk to your child about their autism diagnosis. And the reason that I guess this came about for me and wanting to write about this is because what I noticed is that when we had kids come through the clinic and you know, we diagnosed the child as autistic or ADHD, and then they come back for follow-ups many, many years later, so, you know, 9, 10, 11 plus, and some parents still hadn't told their child that they were autistic. And so I thought, okay, let's have a look at how we can, I guess, support parents to do that, because it is so important, as we mentioned before, that kids know early that, you know, what their neurotype is. So for me, it's about checking in with your feelings first. How do you feel about neurodivergence in general? Do you have any internalized ableism around it? Do you understand what autism is? What does autism look like, I guess, in the culture that you are in? Because, you know, autism, you know, there is stigma in various communities around autism, including obviously, you know, Western communities. So check in first about how you're feeling about that. And if you are feeling, I guess, some stigma or negativity around it, that it might be worth, I guess, working through that first before communicating that to your child, because you want to be able to talk about autism or ADHD in an affirming way to your child. You don't want to be saying that it's, you know, this horrible, terrible thing. So checking in with your feelings and I guess picking a good low demand time. So if your child, you know, goes to school, it might be great to do it during the school holidays. But particularly if your child is asking questions about themselves, so why they're different. So, for example, my son is an autistic ADHDer, and he also has Tourette's. And so he's four. And one day he said to me, "Mama, why does my body make movements that other children, you know, don't? Why do other children's bodies don't move like mine?" And so that was a really great opportunity for me to then come in and talk about this in an affirming way and explain that all of our bodies are different and that's okay. And, you know, I guess to support him to whether or not he felt any embarrassment over it or not, and then to sort of talk about that. And that's the same with communicating neurotypes. So if a child does, I guess, ask, why am I different to others, then it's a really great opportunity to start talking about differences and perhaps doing it in a humorous way. Like my son really enjoys humor. So I'll be like, "Oh, you know, you have a different brain, and how boring would it be if we all had the same brains? Like, how boring would that be?" You know, and then he, you know, giggles and laughs. So really getting down to the child's level and communicating it to them in the way in which they understand. Now, obviously, there are children out there that communicate in different ways. So may not be speaking, may use AAC technologies. So using whatever communication and accommodations that that child requires to be able to communicate to them in an affirming way, and building it into everyday conversations, not making it a big deal as well. Just commenting and saying, oh, yeah, you know, your mate is also autistic like you. See how he's, you know, lining up those cars really cool, or see how she's, you know, really, really loving pink, because I know you like pink, Monique, and saying you like, you know, you're like that too. You know how you like these things. So it's about, I guess, having this shared understanding of how everyone's different and that's okay.
Yeah, I've actually had, you know, because I mainly work with adults, but I've had some parents want to go through their own autism or ADHD assessment process so that they know what it will be like for their child to go through an assessment, and so that they are able to then, you know, if they receive a diagnosis, they're then able to say to their child, well, it's because you're autistic, just like mummy or daddy. And, you know, mummy and daddy, we do the same things as you. And that can be a really great, you know, also another great way to introduce that discussion to your children. I think too, sometimes people are not quite sure what to say, and hearing an example like what you've just given us, Josie, is really helpful. And there are also some really great children's books that introduce the subject of neurodivergence, autism and ADHD, and different brains in an affirming way. And, you know, we could link those in the show notes as well as a resource for people who want to use those children's books as a springboard to bring it up with their children and discuss, you know, what are these things?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the books are so great to be able to, like you said, use as a springboard, you know, even TV shows. You know, on Sesame Street, there's a character, Julia. One of the examples that we give is, you know, notice how Julia needed some quiet time just then, like you do. That's because Julia is autistic, just like you. So again, just sort of talking about it in everyday language, you know, not making a big deal of it. And that's why I think checking in with your feelings is so important to begin with. And then utilizing these resources and the books that you'll link to by, you know, autistic ADHD authors is so fantastic. And kids come into this world not being biased or, you know, thinking that difference is bad. It's unfortunately us adults, you know, society who say, oh, no, we all must be the same. Kids don't want to all be the same. They really love and enjoy difference and uniqueness, and let's capitalize on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a factor for parents as well in telling their child about the child's diagnosis can be how the parents were told the child's diagnosis. So I've had lots of parents come to me and say, you know, like when we were given the news that my child was autistic, it was delivered in a way that made us think that it was a death sentence. And, you know, that sounds extreme, and I acknowledge that, but that is sometimes how autism is spoken about. It's spoken about as this is a death sentence, you know, your child will never be, quote unquote, this expectation or that, they will never achieve X, Y, Z. And it's framed in really negative terms, unfortunately, and that leaves parents feeling shocked and very fearful for their children. And so then if you are told about your child's diagnosis through that lens, of course it would be incredibly frightening and scary to tell your child that they are autistic. And because it's seen as such a bad thing, you may feel like you're trying to protect your child from something that is really scary and bad and fearful. So, you know, I think having the neurodiversity affirming approach through the assessment process, and then also providing the diagnosis and providing adequate psychoeducation to parents when they receive their child's diagnosis, really sets a framework up that then helps families integrate this diagnosis and access resources and things like that that are setting it up as an identity that acknowledges, you know, difficulties and struggles and the need for support, but also that it's not this terrible, like I said, death sentence.
Yeah. 100%. And back 20 years ago when I started in this field, we also would say to maternal child health nurses when we trained them, you know, don't say autism when you're talking about this. Say your child's presenting, you know, with differences in social communication, because people were so worried about what we called the A word, because it was akin to the C word, like cancer. Like, this is how, like, horrible that neurodivergence was viewed back then. And so we're like, okay, well, don't say autism. But absolutely, we changed that in the next iteration of the training, which we started in 2013. And we said, do say autism. You're not diagnosing autism at that screening check. You are identifying that a child is at a higher likelihood of being autistic. And that's because if you're not saying the word autism, then you are just perpetuating the stigma that autism is a bad thing and you shouldn't talk about it ever, ever, ever. So part of our training, in fact, a huge part of our training, is training nurses on how to have those conversations with parents in an affirming way, that it's not the end of the world, because the very first words that come out of, you know, the health professional's mouth about autism is going to impact the way that that family and that parent thinks about autism for a very, very long time. So even before the diagnostic assessment, at that identification check, absolutely they need to, the professional needs to know how to communicate this in a way that acknowledges challenges, but also is not saying that this is the worst thing could ever happen, because then what happens is not only does it impact the way that families feel about autism, but it can act as a barrier for them even seeking a diagnosis. So you need to train your early health professionals like GPs, maternal child health, pediatricians on how to raise autism in an affirming way. And then the way in which you communicate a diagnosis to a family is also in an affirming way. And, you know, we, as part of our clinic, are going to be developing, a session that is just purely dedicated to what autism is, framing autism in an affirming way and answering questions by parents so that they don't spiral into this sort of negative self-talk about what autism and ADHD is.
So how can families and parents access early identification? Because, you know, you have an early identification clinic. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so the clinic that we run, so the Victorian Early Assessment Clinic, provides neurodiversity affirming assessments for kids under three. And the way in which kids get to this clinic is either via referral from the maternal child health nurse. So if you want a screening check for autism, you can go to your maternal child health nurse in Victoria, and also many other areas in Australia as well, but it's not statewide in other states. And you can also self-refer to this clinic. So it's at La Trobe University, and we have a model whereby we offer telehealth assessment, and then face-to-face assessment with the child and the family, and then a feedback session, and then a support session for families afterwards.
So, Josie, we've been talking a lot about early identification, means early diagnosis and access to supports, which, you know, improves the outcomes and quality of life for autistic people. So there has been some discussion over the past couple of years around the NDIS, which in Australia is basically a national disability insurance scheme that provides public funding to support disabled individuals within Australia. And it is based on what we call the social model of disability, which is looking at trying to remove barriers for people with disabilities to access all different levels of the community and society, engage in employment. So there has been discussion within the public sphere around autism being overdiagnosed and people being diagnosed with autism just to get on the NDIS. So I would love to look at what does the research and evidence actually say about this argument?
Yeah, so I've also written another conversation piece about this with my colleague, Dr. Nancy Sadkar, which really debunks the myth that autism is being overdiagnosed. We have known for many, many years that the prevalence of autism is much higher than was been traditionally reported because of the studies that we did, which was screening the general population for autistic traits and then diagnosing in clinic the children that were obviously autistic. And so that gives you a much more accurate reading of what true prevalence is, as opposed to asking people, were you diagnosed with autism? Were you diagnosed with autism? Because if you were missed, then you're going to have an underrepresentation. And so even when the NDIS was first rolled out, the rates that they used for autism was way under what the prevalence rate was, even in our own studies. If they looked at the studies in Australia, they would have seen that way back in 2010, we were finding, you know, a prevalence of about 1%, which was what the prevalence was at the time. And then in the latest study, we found a prevalence of around 3%. And so when you look at the data, Australia's rates of autism diagnosis is very similar across countries. It's very similar for the CDC in America. It's called the Centre for Disease Control, terrible name, but that's the system in which they, you know, monitor for things like autism. The rates are similar across the UK, in Japan, and even in a huge longitudinal study here in Australia, the longitudinal study for Australian children, they found the same prevalence rates as, you know, we had identified and what was reported in, you know, one of these NDIS reports, which is about 4%. So it's very consistent across countries. Then there is the issue of what we call diagnostic overshadowing. So in the past, we often would misdiagnose autistic people as having an intellectual disability or is only having an intellectual disability and not autism. But when we look at the NDIS's own data, we find that there is clear diagnostic overshadowing happening. So in 2017, when we look at the percentage of NDIS participants, 36% had the primary diagnosis of intellectual disability, 29% had a primary diagnosis of autism. Fast forward to 23, autism has overtaken intellectual disability to be 35%, but intellectual disability has decreased to 16%. Right. So if there was a true rise in autistic diagnoses that were not real, then the rates of intellectual disability should have stayed stable while the rates, yes, of autism increased, but they didn't. They crisscrossed. And so now it's showing that we're much better at identifying autism and also at identifying those who have co-occurring autism with intellectual disability. So the NDIS's own data shows that.
Yeah, that's so interesting. What I see within the NDIS data as well is that percentage of people who are accessing this support scheme who are autistic are mainly men. And there is actually an underrepresentation of autistic women on the scheme as well, which I think, you know, reflects that there are people in populations that are undiagnosed, such as women, those assigned female at birth, those from any other minority. So we're seeing a percentage of people on the NDIS that are the most sort of easily diagnosed. And so perhaps it's not that autism is being overdiagnosed. It's actually, like what you said, Josie, we are getting better at identifying autism in women, in older people that are from that lost generation, in people who are other minorities, and they also need support. And if you don't provide that support, what I see clinically is that those people are falling through the cracks. And like I said, having a very poor trajectory.
That's right. So if those who are most vulnerable that need the most help are not accessing NDIS and not getting support through NDIS, which is really supposed to be a prevention model in terms of preventing, you know, further disability because of unresolved, you know, issues or medical issues, disabilities, these individuals are going to end up in the mental health system, in the juvenile system, in the criminal justice system. So the money is still going to be spent, but in different systems, and it's going to be reactive rather than preventative. You know, let's get people the support early that they need, the accommodations that they need, so that we are preventing further disability from occurring, and supporting a disabled individual to be the best disabled individual they can be, not, you know, a neurodivergent person to be the best neurotypical person they can be. So we absolutely need to provide supports for people early in life, because then that means they don't need as many supports later in life. And that's what saves, you know, the economy, because we're not getting sick and getting into the mental health system or into the hospital system or into the criminal justice system.
Yeah, Josie, I think that is such an important perspective, and it's really critical that we analyze the data from this lens to provide the full perspective. And one thing I'll say before we wrap up today's episode is that, you know, I am autistic with low support needs. So I've been, you know, classified as level one autism, if we're going to use those words. That doesn't mean no support needs. So, like I've talked about on the podcast before, I still do require support, even though I'm able to work, but I've never been able to work full time. But that doesn't mean that, yeah, that I'm like any less useful or valuable to society. And in fact, having some supports and accommodations has allowed me to do things like this podcast and help make a difference for, you know, the neurodivergent community. So just wanted to acknowledge that before we wrap up. And yeah, thank you so much for covering this really important topic, sharing your research with us. It's very exciting, and I can't wait to see, you know, how your future research goes. If people would like Josie's SACS protocol to be implemented in the state that they are living in, Australia, lobby the government for it. Why does Victoria get all the good stuff? I know Victoria's amazing, but, you know, I would love to see that across all states in Australia.
Yeah, we get, you know, every single state that, you know, I go to do training in different places have, you know, really, really valued the training. So, you know, I was in Cairns the other day training health professionals from the Torres Cape region, you know, for really rural, remote communities in for our First Nations communities, and they absolutely love that training. I'm going to Wellington next week to train a huge amount of health professionals there. And so anyone that's really received this training has always said how great it is and how it empowers them to have conversations with parents early and in an affirming way, and that they hadn't ever thought about it in that way, and to just thank you for that. So I'm really, really passionate about what I do, and I thank you so much, Monique, and this podcast for giving me the opportunity to talk about this, because honestly, the earlier that we can identify autistic and ADHD kids and have these conversations positively with parents, it genuinely does make lifelong improvements to family quality of life and children's quality of life. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Josie.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to support us further, you can do so by subscribing to our Patreon. To become part of our Patreon community, you can buy us a coffee for $5 per month or a wine for $10 per month.
All of our Patreon subscribers receive access to a backlog of exclusive content, to basic text transcripts from season 4 onwards, and to a monthly live Zoom hangout with us and our Patreon community. Our Zoom hangouts are a place to ask questions, chat about your experiences, and connect with other neurodivergent women.
Patreons shouting us to a monthly wine get all that, plus one exclusive content post per month. We really appreciate your support as we aim to make quality mental health information accessible to everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
If you have a question or would like to contact us, you can do so through our Facebook and Instagram at the handle The Neurodivergent Woman Podcast or our website ndwomanpod.com. You can also email us directly at ndwomanpod@gmail.com. Bye for now.